Chapter 19. There are many wondrous sights to behold in this world, but to Pitt nothing, not even a 30-story rocket blasting into outer space, or a needle-nosed supersonic transport streaking across the sky at twice the speed of sound, could ever look half as incredibly beautiful as that old Ford trimotor, the famed Tin Goose, pitching and rolling awkwardly in the fitful wind, curtained by the black folds of giant menacing clouds. Braced against the increasing gale, he watched intently as the ancient aircraft, graceful in its ugliness, circled Anderson's farm once before the pilot eased back on the throttles, skimmed less than 10 feet over a fence, and set it down in the meadow where the wide-set landing wheels rolled to a complete stop in less than 200 feet from touchdown. Pitt turned to Anderson. "Well, goodbye, golfer. Thank you for all you've done for me. For all of us." Golfer Anderson shook Pitt's hand. "It is I who thank you, Major, for the honor and opportunity to help my fellow brother. God go with you." Pitt couldn't run. His cracked ribs wouldn't permit that. But he covered the distance to the trimotor in less than 30 seconds. Just as he reached the right side of the fuselage, the door flew open and willing arms reached down and pulled him into the cramped, narrow cabin. "Are you Major Pitt?" Pitt looked into the face of a great bull of a man, tan-faced with long blonde sideburns. "Yes, I'm Pitt." "Welcome back to the Roaring Twenties, Major. This is a hell of an idea, using this old flying fossil for a rescue mission." He held out his hand. "I'm Captain Ben Hull." Pitt took the massive paw and said, "Best we move out if we expect to beat the snow." "Right you are," Hull boomed briskly. "No sense in getting ticketed for overparking." If Hull was mildly shocked at Pitt's damaged face or his strange-looking clothes, he concealed it well. "We ran this trip without a co-pilot, a reserved seat in your name, Major. Figured you'd want front-row balcony to lead us to the wreck. Before I signed off, I asked Admiral Sandecker for a couple of items." "Got news for you, Major. That old sea dog carries a big, mean stick. Seems he pulled every plug to get them on board before we took off." He pulled a package from his parka and raised an inquiring eyebrow. "Beats the hell out of me why you'd want a bottle of Russian vodka and a box of cigars at a moment like this." "It's for a couple of friends," Pitt said, smiling. He turned and made his way past 10 men ranged in various relaxed positions along the floor of the cabin. Large, quiet, purposeful-looking men dressed in Arctic weather gear. They were men who were trained in scuba diving, parachute jumping, survival, and nearly every phase of emergency medicine except surgery. A wave of confidence surged through Pitt just from observing them. Ducking his head to clear the low cockpit door, Pitt moved into the cramped confines and eased his sore body into the worn and cracked leather bucket seat, sitting vacant on the co-pilot's side. As soon as he was safely strapped in, he turned and found himself staring into the grinning face of Sergeant Sam Cashman.
"Howdy, Major."
Cashman's eyes widened.
"God almighty, who stomped on your face?"
"Tell you over a drink sometime." Pitt glanced at the instrument panel, quickly familiarizing himself with the old-fashioned gauges. "I'm a bit surprised to see..."
"To see a sergeant flying this mission instead of a genuine flight officer?" Cashman finished. "You got no choice, Major. I'm the only one on the whole island who's checked out on this old bus. Ain't she a winner? She'll take off and land on a dollar bill and give you change."
"Okay, Sergeant, you're in command. Now let's swing this bird into the wind and get her up. Bear due west along the river until I tell you to cut south." Cashman merely nodded. Deftly, he jockeyed the Tin Goose on a 180-degree turn until it faced into the wind at the far side of the meadow. Then he shoved the 3 throttles forward and sent the lumbering old airliner bouncing and shuddering on its way, ever closer to the fence on the opposite end of the field, no more than 300 feet away. As they lurched past the front of Golfer Anderson's little house with the plane's tailwheel still glued to the ground, Pitt began to have a vague idea of what Charles Lindbergh's thoughts must have been when he urged his heavily laden Spirit of St. Louis off the muddy runway of Roosevelt Field back in 1927. It seemed impossible to Pitt that any aircraft short of a helicopter or light two-seater could leave the Earth in so small a space. He shot a fast look at Cashman and saw only icy calmness and total relaxation. Cashman was indifferently whistling a tune, but Pitt couldn't quite make out the melody above the roar of the trio of 200-horsepower engines. There was no doubt, Pitt reflected. Cashman certainly displayed the image of a man who knew how to handle a plane, especially this one.
With two-thirds of the meadow gone, Cashman eased the control column forward and lifted the tail wheel and then pulled back, floating the plane a few feet above the turf. Then, to Pitt's horror, Cashman suddenly dropped the trimotor back hard on the ground, no more than 50 feet in front of the fence. Pitt's horror turned to amazement as Cashman jerked the controls back against his chest and literally bounced the old tin goose over the fence and threw it into the air. "Where in hell did you learn that little trick?" Pitt said, exhaling a great sigh of relief. It was then he recognized the tune Cashman was whistling as the theme from the old movie, Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines. "Used to be a crop duster in Oklahoma," Cashman replied. "How did you wind up as a mechanic in the Air Force?" "One day the junker I was flying developed a nasty cough, plowed up a farmer's pasture, and butchered his champion beef sire years before its time. Everybody in the county was out to sue me. I was flat broke, so I split the scene and enlisted." Pitt couldn't help smiling as he peered through the windshield at the river 200 feet below. From that height, he could easily spot the sloping ridge where Anderson had found him. He saw something now he didn't expect to find. Almost imperceptibly, he became aware of a long, even line against the landscape that trailed off toward the south. He pushed open the little side window and looked again. It was there all right, the dark shade of green against the lighter-tinted tundra. His footprints, where they had sunk into the soft vegetation, had left a path that was as easy to follow as the white line down the center of a highway. Pitt caught Cashman's eye and motioned earthward. "To the south. Follow that dark trail to the south." Cashman banked the plane and stared for a moment out the side window. Then he cocked his head in acknowledgement and turned the nose of the trimotor southward. 15 minutes later, he could only wonder at the unerring trail Pitt had made during his trek to the river. Except for a few occasional deviations around rough or uneven ground, the man-made mark on the earth was almost as straight as a plumb line. 15 minutes, that was all the old antique needed to cover the same distance that had taken Pitt several hours. "I have it now," Pitt shouted. "There, that crack-like depression where my path ends." "Where do you want me to set her down, Major?" "Parallel to the rim of the ravine, there's a flat area running about 500 feet east and west." The sky was darkening by the moment, darkening with the mist of falling snow. Even as Cashman made his landing approach, the first flakes began dotting the windshield, streaking to the edges of the glass before being blown into the sky by the airstream. Pitt's race had been won, but only by the barest of margins. Cashman made a safe landing, a smooth landing, considering the rugged terrain and the difficult wind conditions. He timed his run so that the cabin door of the trimotor ended up within 10 yards of the steep drop-off. The wheels had hardly rolled to a halt when Pitt leaped from the plane and was stumbling, sliding to the bottom of the ravine. Behind him, Hull's men began methodically unloading supplies and arranging them on the dampening ground. Two of the paramedics uncoiled ropes and threw them down the slopes in preparation of bringing up the survivors. Pitt ignored all this. He had one driving desire, to be the first into that chilling pit of hell. He came upon Lily still stretched out on his back with T.D. huddled over him, his head cradled in her arms. She was talking to Lily, saying words Pitt couldn't understand, her voice no more than a weak, hoarse whisper. She seemed trying her best to smile, but her lips barely curved in a pitiful grimace, and there was little pleasantry in either the voice or the eyes. Pitt walked up behind her and gently touched her wet-streaked hair. "It seems you two have become rather close friends." T.D. twisted around and stared dazedly at the figure standing over her.
"Good Lord, you've come back."
She reached out and touched his hand.
"I thought I heard an airplane. Oh, God, this is wonderful. You've come back."
"Yes." Pitt smiled faintly, then nodded at Lily. "How is he?"
"I don't know," she said wearily. "I just don't know. He slipped into unconsciousness about half an hour ago."
Pitt knelt down and listened to Lily's breathing. It was slow and steady. "He'll make it. This guy has guts 10 miles long. The big question is whether he'll ever walk again." T.D. pressed her face against Pitt's hand and began to sob, her breath coming in convulsive shudders, the shock, the pain, and the relief washing over her in rolling waves. He held her tightly, saying nothing. He was still holding her shivering body and stroking her hair as he would a little girl when Captain Hull approached. "Take the girl first," Pitt said. "Her ankles are broken." My men have set up an aid tent above the slopes. There's a stove warming in it now. She'll be comfortable there until the Icelandic search and rescue team can transport her to Reykjavik. Hull wiped his eyes tiredly. Their cross-country vehicles are homing in on our radio signals now. Can't you airlift her out? Hull shook his head. Sorry, Major. That old trimotor can only carry 8 stretcher cases on one trip. I'm afraid the first load will have to be the most critically injured. This is one occasion where the ladies will have to go last. He nodded down at Lily. How bad is this one? Fractured shoulders and pelvis. 2 of Hull's men appeared carrying an aluminum basket stretcher. Take the man first, he ordered, and see that you handle him gently. This one is a back injury. The paramedics carefully eased Lily's inert form into the stretcher and attached the ropes for the ascent to the top of the ravine. Pitt couldn't help but be impressed and thankful for the efficiency and smoothness of the lifting lines. Just 3 minutes later, Hull had returned for Teedy. Okay, Major, I'll take the little lady. Handle her with care, Captain. She happens to be Admiral Sandecker's private secretary. Apparently nothing startled Hull for long. The surprise only flickered in his eyes for an instant. Well, well, he boomed, in that case I'll escort the lady myself. Hull tenderly picked Teedy up in his massive arms and carried her to a waiting basket. Then, true to his word, he climbed along beside her all the way to the top of the slope and saw her comfortably bedded down inside the warm tent before he returned to direct the rescue operation. Pitt pulled the package from under his arm and moved slowly across the broken bottom of the ravine until he stood over the Russian diplomat. Mr. Tomarestov, how are you getting along? A Russian relishes the cold, Major Pitt. He cupped a small handful of snow that had fallen across his chest. Moscow would not be Moscow without a full season of snow. To me, it is the same as desert sand to an Arab, a curse that is part of one's very existence. Are you in pain? An old Bolshevik never admits to pain. A pity, Pitt said. A pity? Tomarestov repeated. He looked at Pitt suspiciously. Yes, I was about to offer you a little something that's guaranteed to relieve discomfort caused by hay fever, headache, and indigestion. More Yankee humor, Major? Pitt let a slight grin touch his face. Yankee sarcasm, he said. The prime reason why we're so often misunderstood by people of other countries. The average American has a sarcastic streak down his back that defies intelligent comprehension. He sat down next to Tomarestov and produced the bottle of vodka. For example, you see before you the fruits of my trip to the corner liquor store. Tomarestov could only stare incredulously. A promise made is a promise kept. Pitt cradled the Russian's head and tilted the bottle to the injured man's lips. Here, drink some of this. Tomarestov easily drained a quarter of the bottle before Pitt eased it away. He nodded his head and mumbled his thanks. Then his eyes took on a warm, penetrating expression. Domestic? True Soviet domestic? How in the world did you manage that? He asked. Pitt tucked the bottle in Tomarestov's armpit. It was on sale, he said. Then he rose and turned to leave. Major Pitt? Yes? Thank you, Tomarestov said simply. He was white with snow, lying there vacantly staring at the clouds when Pitt found him. His face, calm and serene, had the expression of a man untouched by pain, a man who was happy and content and at last at peace with himself. A medic was bending over, examining him. Heart? Pitt asked softly, somehow afraid he might wake him. Considering his age, that's as safe a bet as any, sir. The medic turned and motioned to Hull, who was standing but a few feet away. Shall we evacuate him now, Captain? Leave him lay, Hull said. It's our job to save the living. This man is dead. As long as there is a chance to keep any one of these people from joining him, our attention must go to them. You're right, of course, Pitt said wearily. This is your show, Captain. Hull's tone softened. You know this man, sir? I wish I had known him better. His name is Sam Kelly. The name obviously meant nothing to Hull. Why don't you let us take you topside, Major? You're in a pretty bad way yourself. No, I'll stay with Sam here. Pitt reached over and gently closed Kelly's eyes for the final time and lightly brushed the snowflakes from the old wrinkled face. Then he took a cigar he recognized as Sandecker's special brand from the box and slipped it into Kelly's breast pocket. Hull stood unmoving for nearly a minute, groping for words. He started to say something but thought better of it and instead simply nodded his head in silent understanding. Then he turned and plunged back to work.